You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Robert Bounds. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Israelis prepare to head to the polls tomorrow and it looks like Benjamin Netanyahu and his Likud party will be re-elected. But what were the important issues this time around?
Both the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition, for their different reasons, intended the election to focus almost entirely on domestic issues, on the economy, rather than on the old chestnut, so to speak, of Israel-Palestine peace process and the absence thereof.
And Barack Obama was officially inaugurated for a second term today. We'll check in with our man in New York to see if Americans are as excited as they were 4 years ago.
The origins of our names, what makes us exceptional, what makes us American, is our allegiance to an idea articulated in a declaration made more than two centuries ago. Today, we continue a never-ending journey to bridge the meaning of those words with the realities of our time.
We'll also ask why there's a battle brewing in South Korea over the length of national service.
By cutting the number of months that you have to serve, they will have a shortfall in troops, of about 27,000 troops. Now, Park has said that she can fill that gap by hiring extra troops, but it turns out that hiring, feeding and clothing that many soldiers is actually going to cost about $1 billion a year.
And as world leaders, business CEOs and celebrities are meeting in the exclusive mountain resort of Davos this week, we speak to Steve Bloomfield about what we can expect. And we'll ask why Picasso's famed murals in Oslo might be demolished. All that, plus some great music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's get the news headlines with Paul Osborne.
Barack Obama has said he wants to finish what we started as he is sworn in for a second term as President of the United States.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
In front of a huge crowd in Washington, D.C., the president has taken the oath of office and set out his aims for the next 4 years.
An economic recovery has begun. America's possibilities are limitless, for we possess all the qualities that this world without boundaries demands. Youth and drive, diversity and openness, an endless capacity for risk, and a gift for reinvention. My fellow Americans, we are made for this moment, and we will seize it so long as we seize it together.
37 foreign nationals were among at least 48 hostages killed in the siege at a gas plant in eastern Algeria. The country's prime minister says only three of the militants who overran the facility were captured alive. 29 others were killed. The president of France is warning the operation to push Islamist militants from northern Mali will take time, despite initial success. 2,000 French troops have been sent to the country to assist Malian forces. François Hollande has warned people must be patient. He's won the support of Tanzania's president, Jakaya Kikwete, after talks in Paris.
The problems in Mali should be seen as a problem where all of us in the international community have to contribute to help the people of Mali against these extremist Islamists.
Reports from Eritrea say soldiers have surrounded the Ministry of Information in the capital, Asmara. State TV has gone off the air in what some analysts have suggested may be a coup attempt, but the city is said to be calm. Israel's Prime Minister has made his last appeal to voters on the eve of the country's election. Benjamin Netanyahu asked wavering voters to come home to his Likud party. It's standing in coalition with an ultra-nationalist party in an election which analysts have said could see the most right-wing government in Israel's history take office. Aviation safety officials investigating the problems with Boeing's 787 Dreamliner have been speaking to the manufacturers of the plane's batteries. The company says it's fully cooperating with the investigation. All 50 Dreamliners currently in service were grounded last week after one plane was forced to make an emergency landing. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Well, thank you, Paul, at 18.05 here in London. You are tuned in to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljat, Monocle 24.
Este é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Dette Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
It's the final hours of campaigning before Israelis head to the polls tomorrow to elect a new government. And according to the latest polling, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu looks set to return to power with a coalition that's moving increasingly to the right. In addition to the usual foreign policy issues that dominate elections in Israel, domestic issues are also playing big this time around. The rising cost of living and a slew of austerity cuts has garnered headlines during the campaign and has seen many Israelis turn their back on Netanyahu. But his Likud party is expected to win roughly 33 seats in tomorrow's vote. That's 9 less than they currently hold. Many voters have been turning to the Jewish Home Party, which has seen their popularity rise more than expected. But as with many election campaigns, the dash to the finish line has seen a few unexpected surprises. So joining me on the line now from Jerusalem is Monocle's Joseph Danner. Thank you for joining us, Joseph.
Good evening.
What are the unexpected twists in the road on tonight's TV news in Jerusalem then?
Well, the latest kind of squabble in this election saga is coming from the Jewish Home Party. They're accusing Likud, which is basically their main contender in these elections, of leaking a video to the media of one of their party members talking about either blowing up the Dome of the Rock or being fond of the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem being blown up. And so this is a very kind of, you know, insightful video that's been released to the media. And today they've come out, the Jewish Home Party, really with kind of guns blazing, attacking the Likud and accusing them of kind of, you know, malpractice in the election arena, as it were.
And this is a pretty amazing piece of news. The Jewish Home Party, led by Naftali Bennett, have obviously sort of not exactly come from nowhere, but they've never had such a strong showing, certainly in the lead up to the election, as polls are suggesting right now. Why are they so bullish, and why do they think they can take on Likud over this video, for example?
Well, like you said, they've kind of come out of nowhere, but they do represent a certain sentiment that's been growing in intensity in Israeli society, and that is really this kind of defiance that a lot of Israelis have. This was really clear after the Palestinian statehood bid at the United Nations, in which Israel basically responded to this bid by saying that they were going to increase settlement activity. And so this Jewish Home Party is very much in line with these sentiments, saying, you know what, we're not going to give up the West Bank. We have no intention of doing so. We have no intention of seeing a Palestinian state being created on our borders. And if you don't like it, you can deal with it. And so we have these videos coming out of their party kind of stalwarts, saying very, very insightful things about Palestinians and about the current situation, very much at odds with the international community's consensus on the Israeli-Palestinian kind of question. And Israelis seem to be kind of accepting this. And so one of the real kind of issues of the election tomorrow, the actual voting, will be to see exactly how many seats this party gets. It's projected that they're going to get about 14 seats. And if they go above that, Naftali Bennett is probably going to be one of the most powerful politicians in Israeli politics in the next year, which is an incredibly, you know, somewhat disastrous development, at least as far as the international community is concerned.
And this, the way that this video has played out and the confidence of that Jewish Home Party, does that sort of bode for the future of the Knesset? As you said, if they achieve a certain number of seats, Naftali Bennett will have an almost, will have a linchpin role in the Knesset, presumably.
Exactly. And the way that this Knesset's kind of complexion is going to look very much hinges on Naftali Bennett's, you know, power, how many seats he gets tomorrow, as well as the Palestinian Israeli turnout. This is always a kind of wild card. People don't know how Palestinian citizens of Israel are going to vote, or more importantly, whether or not they are even going to go to the polls and vote at all. And so if there's a big showing from the Palestinian sector of society, this could change the complexion. And then finally, we have the Labor Party, this kind of
you know, it's this dwindling party that is a real foundational aspect of Israeli politics that has just been dropping over recent years. And so if that party doesn't have a very strong showing, this is also going to really, you know, kind of play into the hands of this newly resurgent kind of iconoclastic right that we see in the form of the Jewish Home Party and Naftali Bennett himself.
And before we leave the sort of maybe the international arena behind and go to some of these domestic policies we queued up in the intro, Joseph, maybe you can maybe give us a little bit of insight into what's wrong with the left in Israel, why it can't seem to pull itself together to fight this country that's lurching right.
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, it starts with the fact that a lot of Israelis now, basically an entire generation of Israelis have been born into the occupation. They understand their political relationship with the Palestinians in these occupation types of terms, and they've seen an entrenchment of this occupation, as well as dwindling kind of social conditions for themselves inside of Israel, and they just have been kind of lost, to be quite honest, and listless in terms of finding a voice that can articulate a clear vision that will end this cycle of occupation, as well as deliver on the social justice kind of, you know, promises that so many Israelis are demanding. And so there was a bit of a glimmer of hope 2 years ago when the social justice protesters kind of took over Tel Aviv in these very dramatic, you know, kind of very anti-Netanyahu protests. And then a lot of the leaders of that movement actually kind of jumped on board into the Labour Party ticket. And so now two of the main candidates for the Labour Party are actually, you know, coming from this social justice movement, which is kind of a blow for these grassroots activists that were trying to get out of the establishment. And so I think really the answer when it comes to the Israeli left is that they're very confused. And while they're confused, the Jewish Home Parties and the Likud are very not confused. They're very organized and they're very defiant. And so in that really, you know, kind of murky constellation, we see a lot of listless liberal Israelis, as it were.
So if we can expect a return to Netanyahu, albeit in coalition form, we should talk about some of the issues that are dominating the home news headlines, Joseph. Austerity measures are something that we don't hear about much of in world news about Israel, but clearly it's an issue in the country itself. Maybe you can tell us about some of these domestic issues.
Absolutely. I mean, this election has really been typified by a kind of bread and butter issues. The social issues have dominated the discourse. Netanyahu himself, in his last press conference before the election, came out and kind of waved some housing reform in front of voters, you know, promising that he's going to address what is really an endemic problem of housing costs inside of Israel. You know, in the place of these you know, normal discussions about Israeli-Palestinian issues, about the occupation and the regional situation of Israel, has been this intense social debate as to where this country is going, how the tax structure is going to be changed, how you know, the medical structure is going to be changed. And so this is, if you were to ask the average Israeli, you know, what are the pressing issues that they're going to the polls for tomorrow, it's not going to be about the occupation, more or less. It's going to be about social issues. And the right has really done an excellent job of, you know, kind of mobilizing their base to ignore the incredible amounts of money that go to the occupation, that go to the Israeli settlements in the West Bank, in a way that that kind of paints them as, I guess, social democrats in a sort of fashion. So it's a bit confusing from the outside, but this is really what's dominating the political discourse inside.
All right, Joseph. Well, before we go, just one final question. Without wanting to get too meta about this, as we're the news reporting on the news, but is that a bit of a problem seeing it from the outside yourself, that we know so little of the issues actually confronting sort of the social issues in Israel, only the big ones about borders?
Right. Well, Israel is a very complex society. It's a society that is rooted in a very kind of clear form of socialism, at least we would call it socialism, looking at it from especially the American perspective. And over the last couple of years, they've adopted a lot of neoliberal reforms, and it's become a very kind of almost predatory capitalist society. And those changes, coupled with the regional changes and the ongoing issues with the Palestinians, has created a very odd environment in which there's a couple of tycoons that are able to very much control the situation on the ground economically, and a lot of people that are just out on their luck and that are, you know, really struggling to make ends meet. I mean, not many people realize, if you haven't been to Tel Aviv, but the prices in Tel Aviv are, you know, astronomical. I mean, sometimes it feels like you're living in Paris or something like this. And so, you know, this is very much an issue that many Israelis are grappling with, and what happens tomorrow will be very interesting in terms of how the course of the country goes in terms of bettering these economic situations.
Well, thank you very much, Joseph Danner, for being with us on the line from Jerusalem. Coming up next, we'll find out why some South Koreans are angry that the length of mandatory national service might be getting cut.
If you think the print industry is on its last legs, then you haven't tuned into The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review of the best in paper, ink, varnishes, and glue. Every Saturday morning, we sit down with an informed group of editors, journalists, art directors, and photographers to flip through their favorite periodicals.
There's a huge amount of arrogance going into this, but it's got confidence and pride, and that makes for a fantastic end result.
It's a matter of pride to be involved in certain magazines. It's not about the reach and numbers, it's about the reach and quality.
Matte or glossy, saddle stitched or perfect bound, The Stack is an hour of opinions, predictions, and proclamations about all the titles we hoard, archive, and savor.
There is a real difference, and the difference will become more sharply edged as time goes on.
The biggest breakfast buffet of magazines and newspapers is served up every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brûlé, and a passionate mix of print aficionados.
I think it's real when it's ink. You can take it home and it doesn't flicker.
Home to almost every alpine cliché you can imagine, Switzerland's remote Lower Engadine has its own brand of old-fashioned charm. Monocle's film crew put on their snow boots to capture a world lost in time.
In earlier times, there was a clear hierarchy in the village. First of all came the priest, then the teacher, then the blacksmith. The one who controlled the fire, actually the master of the fire, that was then, in the belief of the people, a bit a higher person.
Mountain Magic on Monocle.com.
Well, it's 1817 here in London, which makes it, of course, time for Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. Time now for our weekly briefing from our defence correspondent, Trevor Moss. Earlier, Trevor spoke to our news editor, Tom Edwards, and they talked about Indonesia's plan to buy 3 frigates from the UK. But they started by discussing the battle facing South Korea's incoming president, Park Geun-hye, over her election pledge to cut national service from 21 months to 18.
Well, one of her ideas on the campaign was that she proposed to cut compulsory military service from 21 months, as it is now, to 18 months, which is obviously a popular policy because it helped her to get elected, but it's not a popular policy with the military, as it turns out, who are now come out and said that they oppose this move. Their point is that by cutting the number of months that you have to serve, they will have a shortfall in troops, of about 27,000 troops. Now, Park has said that she can fill that gap by hiring extra troops, but it turns out that, you know, hiring, feeding and clothing that many soldiers is actually going to cost about $1 billion a year. Now, the military in South Korea has a lot of other big priorities. They're looking to buy a new fighter jet right now, for example. They're plowing money into new missile systems, and they don't really have $1 billion lying around. So, you know, there's a bit of a problem now for Park, because she doesn't want to have to drop this policy on day one of her administration, but also she doesn't want to have a row with the military. So she's got a bit of a dilemma now.
I just wondered, how much do you think of her first term is going to be spent dealing with military issues? There's obviously the threats, perceived and real, from the North, and South Korea trying to position itself, you know, internationally, the kind of alliances it's trying to strike. Is this going to be a massive preoccupation for her?
Well, I think it's going to be a preoccupation for any South Korean leader. I mean, Park is looking to re-engage with North Korea, and everyone hopes that tensions will be low and that negotiations will go somewhere. But North Korea being as it is, there's always a likelihood that something will flare up, and military readiness is crucial for South Korea. And the idea that there's not going to be enough soldiers or not enough money to hire new soldiers, that's just not going to work. So
So she's going to have to find a way through this. But, I mean, in the end, she may just have to tell the military that in a democracy, when you campaign on certain policies, they just have to be carried through. So we'll see what she does.
Now, Trevor, returning to the UK, we've spoken before about possible new markets, lucrative markets in many cases, for the UK to exploit overseas in terms of defence contracts. One we've discussed before is Indonesia, and I gather that there's been further developments on that market front, certainly from the UK's point of view.
Well, that's right. Philip Hammond, who's the British Defence Minister, has been in Jakarta this week, and what's resulted from that is that Indonesia is going to buy three second-hand frigates from the Royal Navy. And this is part of a trend we've been seeing across Southeast Asia. Countries like the Philippines and Thailand buying US Navy frigates. Now Indonesia is doing the same thing with the UK. But it's really important for the UK because Indonesia is obviously a bit of a sleeping giant in Asia. The UK's latched onto it really as a growth market for defence equipment. And Jakarta has already bought some Hawk jet trainers from the UK. Now we have these frigates and probably some further bigger sales coming down the line, or at least that's what London's looking for.
I just wondered, who are the key rivals then with the UK for this potentially very lucrative Indonesian business? Is it the kind of traditional arms and defence exporters that we would imagine?
Well, certainly South Korea, which is a very up-and-coming military equipment supplier, has done a lot of business with Indonesia. They're selling them three new submarines in a very big deal. The US is also in there. China, Germany just sold tanks to Indonesia. So there are a lot of other competitors. I think the UK has positioned itself pretty well. They're probably going to be supplying these frigates on very favorable terms to the Indonesians, in the hope that, you know, that this will translate into more lucrative sales further down the line.
Now, Trevor, I'm sure you'll be aware that one story we've been following very closely on Monocle 24 during the last few days has been Boeing's travails with its 787 Dreamliner. And obviously, you know, rolling out these very advanced aircraft can be a tricky proposition. And I gather that in military aircraft, the same is true.
Well, that's right. I mean, the aircraft that we're looking at here is called the A400M, which is built by Airbus Military. And it's really had a lot of trouble, like the 787 Dreamliner. This aircraft was a really big deal for the European defense industry because it was a combined effort to break into the heavy military transport aircraft market, which is currently completely dominated by the two big U.S. defense firms, Boeing and Lockheed Martin. Now, this program, like so many defense programs, it was, you know, over budget. Schedules were slipping badly. A couple of international customers actually cancelled their orders. And a couple of years ago, you know, this program was in real crisis. It looked like it might fall apart. But they managed to survive that crisis period, push through that. And the news this week is that the first production aircraft has been rolled out. It's destined for use in the French Air Force. So it's really a huge milestone for that program. Clearly, it's going to survive now. A lot of European and other air forces waiting for that aircraft, and the European defence industry, I think, has a really good program now that it can look to making some profits in the future.
I was going to ask just finally and briefly, it's interesting you make that point about the European defence industry more broadly. It's obviously been struggling somewhat of late. Is this the perfect kind of fillip, or do you think this is maybe slightly, you know, we shouldn't invest too much hope that this is the sign of better things to come?
Well, I mean, this program just itself is probably going to be a winner because this aircraft is coming at a time when Boeing's big transport aircraft is going to be coming off the market. Lockheed Martin's Hercules, which is a very successful and well-known aircraft, is actually a bit smaller than the A400M, doesn't do quite the same things. So there's a great opportunity to sell a lot of these around the world. And generally, the European defense market is, you know, it's starting to get its act together a little bit, consolidating. We're seeing companies very active in growth markets like the UK is in Indonesia. And so the hope is that things aren't going to get any worse in Europe. Things are going to get better elsewhere in the world, in places like Asia and the Middle East. So hopefully there could be better times ahead.
All right, and that was Monocle's defence correspondent Trevor Moss talking to Tom Edwards a little earlier on. And you're tuned in to Midori House. Up next, we check in with our man in New York City to see what's making the headlines in the Apple. Just a quick one. It was just a quick one, wasn't it? One of my favourite little stings. Welcome back to Midori House at 1824 here in London, which means it's lunchtime. It means it's half past lunchtime in New York City, almost where we're heading next. On the line now from New York Bureau is Monocle's Barrett Austin, who's a very full plate of stories for us. Let's kick off things, Barrett. As you might have expected, we'd ask, with inauguration fever. Is it inauguration fever, or are people just sort of tuned in out of habit?
I think there is a sense of inauguration fever. It's not the same sense of excitement that you had back in 2009. I remember watching the event as a university student in my final year of school, and there was this tremendous sense of excitement. It's something that you heard about for weeks and weeks sort of leading up to it. And anywhere that you went, all television screens were focused on this. Today, I would say the atmosphere is a bit different. Inevitably, when presidents are sort of sworn in for their second time, you don't have as many people paying attention. But nonetheless, there is a big focus on it. I think in 2009, there were around 1.8 million people who crowded the National Mall in Washington, D.C. for the event. Today, you have 700,000 people. That may seem like a big jump, but if you look back at when George W. Bush was sworn in for his second term, there were fewer than 300,000 people that were there. So yeah, I think it's still quite exciting.
And we should talk about the music, the musical acts, the turns that rocked the inauguration. Beyoncé kind of took everyone's breath away. There's been a lot of talk on it in newspapers online here in the UK. What's been the feeling in the US? It was sort of Kelly Clarkson versus Beyoncé, wasn't it?
I think so. Obviously, James Taylor, sort of a classic folk artist, he came out and did a good song. But yeah, I think there was a bit of competition between Beyoncé and Kelly Clarkson. I think some of us were surprised to see Kelly Clarkson up on stage. But nonetheless, I think you're entirely accurate in saying that all eyes were on Beyoncé.
Well, maybe Kelly Clarkson's there to kind of get the key demographic, to get those kind of to get the flyover states going, Barrett. Maybe that's what it is, to get them tuned in.
As anyone who has a close eye on sort of the science behind politics, like our very own Sasha Eisenberg would tell you, there is a lot of sort of placement amongst people like this, sort of to get the right demographics going. I think she did quite well. I'm not sure if that was the case, but I wouldn't be entirely skeptical if that was in fact the reasoning behind it.
And Obama himself, how did he do? What sort of mood was he in? Clearly, it's a speech that is much practiced in the mirror before he goes out in front of all those people. What was his performance like?
I think he did really well. Looking back at his first inauguration speech, I would say that, you know, obviously more eyes were on that speech, but I think he was quite powerful. The circumstances that this country's facing this year are completely different. If we look back then, we were in two wars and facing one of the most tremendous economic recessions that this country has ever dealt with. Today, obviously, the circumstances have changed. We're out of one of those wars. We're drawing down from another. We've made tremendous progress in the economic recession that we're facing. The speech, I think, overall was quite optimistic, but nonetheless, he made allusions to a need for the U.S. to overhaul its tax code, the need for sustained reform in the educational system. He brought up the issue of climate change, which is something that's been noticeably absent from his platform, and he's received a lot of criticism for. And he continued on with the issue of, you know, civil rights for both women and gay Americans, the idea that women deserve fair pay. All in all, it was by no means a policy speech, but he made sort of great allusions to what his plan is for the next couple of years.
And also, it's Martin Luther King Day. How does that work when it's the same day as the inauguration?
Well, I was thinking about this earlier, thinking, gosh, this is so incredibly symbolic. And apparently, it would have been much better if the White House had just said, no, we planned it this way. But apparently, there was some sort of scheduling to do that ended up putting, you know, the two together. But nonetheless, I think there's a tremendous symbolic value in the fact that President Obama is being sworn in now for his second term on the same day as we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. It's worth noting, I think, that one of the Bibles that President Obama used in the swearing-in today was, in fact, Martin Luther King Jr.'s very own Bible.
Yeah, and it's a funny thing that people have been saying, you don't know it's Martin Luther King Day until your bank's closed. And then, of course, Inauguration Day comes on the same day. Not making light of it, but it's got an extra added kind of sort of moral weight to it, right?
I think so. I mean, it's a big day. Martin Luther King Jr. is one of the individuals in this country that's remembered as, some people have described him as the greatest American. I was reading a story that Martin Luther King Jr.'s memorial, which opened not so long ago, is just about a 15-minute walk away from the National Mall where President Obama is being sworn in today. And apparently there have been many, many people sort of circling by, and I can only imagine that the next couple of hours you'll have many people going to his memorial site and paying homage to his legacy.
All right, well, the time being, Barrett, enjoy the rest of your inauguration and MLK Day. Thank you very much for joining us over lunch. We'll be back next to tell you what's coming up in the next half hour of the show.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, desde Londres,
Holanda,
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 18:30 on Midori House here in London. In the next 30 minutes of the show, we'll be speaking to Monocle's Steve Bloomfield about what we can expect at this year's World Economic Forum, and we'll find out why two murals by Pablo Picasso are under threat in Oslo. But first, at the bottom of the hour, is the news headlines with Paul Osborne.
Barack Obama has urged America to seize the moment as he's sworn in for a second term as President of the United States. In front of a huge crowd in Washington, D.C., the president took the oath of office and said Americans must unite to confront the challenges of the future. 37 foreign nationals were among those killed in the siege at a gas plant in eastern Algeria. The country's prime minister says only three of the militants who overran the facility were captured alive. 29 others were killed. The president of France is warning the operation to push Islamist militants from northern Mali will take time, despite initial success. François Hollande has warned people in France and Mali must be patient. Reports from Eritrea say soldiers have surrounded the Ministry of Information in the capital, Asmara. State television has gone off the air in what some analysts have suggested may be an attempted coup. The city, though, is said to be calm. And Israel's prime minister has made his last appeal to voters on the eve of the country's election. Benjamin Netanyahu asked wavering voters to come home to his Likud party, which is standing in coalition with an ultra-nationalist group, in an election which some analysts have said could see Israel's most right-wing ever government take office. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House, live on Monocle 24. For decades, Afghanistan has long been at the centre of a contest between democracy and Islamist extremism. Even today, the country struggles with life post-Taliban and getting back to a sense of normality after more than 10 years of war. Our next guest, Tamim Ansari, has a unique history, an Afghan background, Muslim roots and a Western upbringing. He's written a new book titled Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. In it, Tamim explores the history of Afghanistan from the inside, looking out, and discusses what role foreign powers have had for this country. Tamim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I like the subtitle or the surtitle of your book, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. What's everyone been fighting over for so long? The Soviets, the British before them. It's always been in the middle of a lot of international jostling.
Well, it certainly has. You know, the title has two parts, the often interrupted history of Afghanistan. So I wanted to suggest that Afghanistan has a history apart from the invasions and interruptions, but it is constantly being invaded and interrupted. And the reason is it happens to be in the spot where great global powers arguing about geopolitical matters, that's the line of scrimmage for them and the field of play. They're basically actually fighting each other for position, and they're interested in Afghanistan almost inevitably because they don't want the other side to get Afghanistan.
So this is the old problem. It's kind of keep your enemy's enemy closer almost. It's one of those things as well. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about your own story. Maybe it's easier to write a book looking as an Afghan from the outside and looking back into the country.
Well, you know, I was I spent my first 16 years in Afghanistan. I was born and raised there. My father is an Afghan. He was one of the first Afghans sent abroad to get a Western university education. So he married my mother, an American woman, brought her back. She was the first American woman in Afghanistan. So I was raised there. Then I came here to go to school and did not go back until the Taliban were ousted. So many years in United States.
And your book, in the first few pages of the book, it's got a cast of characters, which is quite unusual for a non-fiction book, right? Which I really like. I love that idea, and it's got all sorts of sort of old British generals and sort of war and Afghan warlords in it. Yeah. Maybe you can give us a bit of a taste of some of the key characters in the book throughout the sort of history of the country.
Well, of course, in the first Anglo-Afghan War, I think the most fascinating character was Alexander Burnes on the British side. He was the political agent, which basically means the intelligence chief at that time. And he was a guy who really was so, sympathetic to Afghans. He liked Afghans. He was sure they liked him. And it's a tragic thing that, on a certain day when he said, everything is fine in Afghanistan, it's all under control, 2 days later, he was surrounded by a mob in his house and he was killed.
The often interrupted history of him as well. So that seems like a sort of typically Afghan sort of story, that it's an the unpredictability of it.
The unpredictability of it, yes. But then on the other side, the perhaps most interesting character is Amir Abdurrahman Khan. And he was a guy that after the second Anglo-Afghan War, the British said, we can't take it anymore. Can we just hand this over to somebody? And he said, me. And then he turned out to be this astonishing strongman that next to whom Bismarck would look like a wuss.
I like the word wuss used in news interviews. I think that's just... and is that the sort of thing that that Afghans respond to? Is there a strength? Because there's a great poetry, there's a great sort of literary tradition, there's a great oral tradition, now that your book is part of it in Afghan culture. But is strength something that is very much respected as well?
Well, strength is respected, and he was a strong man. But I would say that Afghan culture, it's a mixture of admiring strength and a sort of an over-the-top generosity is one of the features of the Afghan character. And then on top of that, there's honor and other kinds of virtues that that cause people to regard someone as a leader.
And you went back to Afghanistan for the first time in 10 years recently. And what did you see when you went? How had it changed? I mean, I guess this makes it into the back of your book as well.
Well, first of all, I went back 10 years ago. And it had in some ways not changed at all in 38 years or whatever it was that I was away. Everything had been destroyed. The city was rubble. My neighborhood was not there anymore. But the sense of the people and the social life was that sort of timeless calm that was still there. I went back 10 years later this last spring, and Kabul at least was so clamorous, so overrun by technology, so, hurry, bustle, busyness. I felt like it had changed more in the last 10 years than it had in the 38 before that.
And is that due to sort of outside influences? Because the
Absolutely.
Taliban is sort of is strength, I guess the grip kind of strengthens and loosens, it seems, kind of like in a fairly secular fashion. But is it the outside influence that brings what you described as the glamour or maybe the modernity?
Well, glamour, modernity, and dog-eat-dog competitive, sort of. And some of that certainly is because billions of dollars have been pouring into this place from every possible angle. And that's what the Afghan economy, I was going to say, largely consists of. I'll amend that by saying, and then on the other side, opium from the bottom, it's just coming up. That's the other economic source of...
Economic success story.
Yeah. And then they're intermingled, of course.
Yeah, well, exactly. And does writing a history book with a very personal element to it as well, does it help you make predictions for the future of the country?
Yes and no. One of the main
you
things
didn't want to be asked that question, did you?
Well, one of the main things is that I think I feel less certain about the future than many other people that I hear from. Some people say, "Oh, it's going to collapse in the civil war, Taliban will take over, etc." But I really say we don't know because there's so much, there's so many new factors in the Afghan cultural scene.
And I wonder whether you can sort of delineate all these rival factions and whether or not you feel that they've been strengthened or kind of maybe some of their power taken away by the what we might call an allied involvement in Afghanistan over the last few years and a sort of standing army.
Well, you know, one thing is on the Taliban side, the Taliban is a very diffuse and fragmented phenomenon. So that's one thing. And on the other side, I think one of the main things is that technology, without anybody being in control of it, has entered and has started to permeate. So even villages have TV sets now, and they can get news stations from Kabul. And then, in that case, it's very important that Kabul has a vigorous, independent news media, a crusading news media, one that, you know, they dare do things that I don't see happening on this side.
That's the thing. Can that happen? I mean, how dynamic is that sort of media culture in Kabul? Is that getting stronger?
It is strong, and it's getting stronger. It's incredibly dynamic. I'm astonished to see, you know, the independence of that media and the helplessness of both the government and the Taliban to shut it down. They go in there and they find stuff out, and then they broadcast it. And if villagers have TV sets, now they see that stuff. So,
and that's one of the keys, presumably. That must be something that you see as a civilizing influence, that there is at least, hopefully, that the media itself is a bit of a dog-eat-dog world, and people are kind of competing to tell the news to each other.
Yes, yes. I have hope from that angle.
All right. For the time being, Tamim Ansari, author of Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan, thank you very much for joining us. It features characters that make Bismarck look like a wuss. That's straight from the author himself. You are tuned in to Midori House. We'll be right back in a second with a look at what to expect at this year's World Economic Forum.
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes, and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks, and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
From a breed of Italian sheep brought back from extinction to vintage recipes revitalizing the dairy business in a remote part of Norway, Monocle Films brings you inspiring tales of mountain producers on a mission.
Mikhail's restaurants depend on locally sourced produce for its recipes, which have attracted a faithful following. It's proof, if ever proof were needed, that when restaurants work in collaboration with local food producers, it's possible to make a sustainable business out of organic farming and to create a distinct regional culinary identity.
Making it work in the mountains on monocle.com.
Okay, it's 1843 in London. It's Midori House coming to you live from Midori House in London. And in the spirit of our next story about the World Economic Forum in Davos, this is a song called Little Numbers by Boy. Little Numbers by Boy on Midori House at 1846 here in London. Now, every year, prime ministers and presidents, CEOs, celebrities and the creme de la creme of the art, tech and academic world gather in the snow-capped mountains surrounding Davos. The annual World Economic Forum brings together the most powerful business and political figures to hash out the world's problems. This year, the five-day conference will focus on how to restart the battered global economy. Delegates will debate issues like the Eurozone crisis, America's fiscal problems and how to kickstart growth. The conference also gives delegates a chance to schmooze with some of the most influential people on the planet. Tomorrow, Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, one of the most influential people on the planet, will be joining joining the who's who of the business world at Davos. And on Wednesday and Thursday, we'll be presenting Midori House live from the slopes.
I will.
Steve, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you very much.
A warm-up, perhaps, for tomorrow and the next, or Wednesday and Thursday for you.
A warm-up, yes. And certainly here right now is going to be a lot warmer than it will be in Davos, where I'm reliably informed it's currently -6.
Oh, that would be good.
Yeah.
That'll keep all the delegates inside. It'll keep smoking breaks down to a minimum. Hopefully the world's problems will be sorted in Davos. Is that the sort of thing that is meant to happen at Davos? We said it in the introduction.
Is it
a big social club, or is it a proper talking shop?
It is and it isn't. It depends who you speak to. Let's get one thing straight. These people are the sort of people that, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, would have described themselves as the great and the good. They were the masters of the universe. So it's only fair to point out they're also the people that have pretty much screwed up the global economy for the rest of us. Some of them have apologised. Some of them have got some interesting ideas about how things can change. Some of them, less repentant. So
you'll be walking around the big stick.
Have you said sorry yet? No, right. So I think it'll be interesting to see how the debate moves on this year. I think particularly because, you know, a number of the delegates there have been very much behind the austerity drives we've been seeing, not just in Europe, but elsewhere in the world. And yet, you know, in the past 12 months since the last time they all gathered, there's been growing evidence that austerity hasn't really worked. And so some of them are starting to think again about, you know, exactly what needs to be discussed. There'll be some things that sound very boring, like discussions of Basel III, which is the new sort of international banking laws, but are, as you'd expect with international banking laws, actually quite important.
Yeah, exactly.
And there'll also be some set-piece speeches from prime ministers, politicians, presidents, and so on, which will be worth looking out for to see. Because they're all, obviously, they're not just talking to their audience of bankers and economists in front of them, they're talking mainly to their electorates at home. So it'll be interesting to see what they say.
And it's a funny thing. I mean, is Davos, is there a big programme of events that you can sort of whiz through and look at speeches and look at who's talking to who? It's not set up like a trade fair or something where there is it, but it sort of does have that similar feel. I guess half the business is presumably done in parties late at night over Glühwein and Schnapps.
I think there will be a lot of that, yes. The organisers of Davos, the World Economic Forum, are slightly wary about their reputation and how they're perceived these days. They don't want the rest of us to think that they're all just, you know, drinking champagne and having wonderful meals and flying in on their private jets. They want to give the impression that, no, we are serious people having serious discussions. But obviously there is an evenings, there are some events.
There's a roster. I think there's a fairly hearty roster.
There are things that will go on. Right. And it's interesting as well. I mean, you know, Davos is, you know, it's a pretty small town. It doesn't deal with this sort of thing the rest of the year. And I was talking to one of the organisers a few weeks ago about, you know, restaurants and, you know, where's good to eat. And he just said, nowhere's good to eat. Nowhere. I thought, well, how do all these, you know, big CEOs and presidents, says they all fly in chefs from elsewhere to...
It's a funny thing. It's kind of like, I think people bring their own retinue of obviously security and also right down to the man that can mix the right kind of cocktail for their evening parties, right?
Exactly.
I think it's not necessarily a town that serves the purpose of this. It's not like they go to... It's not maybe... You could possibly do it in Samaritz.
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, when we do our shows, so we get, as you said in the introduction, we're doing Midori House on Wednesday and Thursday.
Yes. Now you must plug your shows and tell people when they can tune into this.
So that's 1900 hours if you're in Switzerland, 1800 hours London time. That's Wednesday and Thursday. And also we're going to be co-hosting the briefing. That's noon, 12 noon London time. 1300 hours Swiss time. So that'll be a London Davos co-production. We've got lots of interesting economists and journalists and CEOs booked. Gideon Rackman from the Financial Times, Felix Salmon, who's the brilliant financial columnist at Reuters. We're also going to be speaking to some of the young global leaders. Every year Davos chooses.
I didn't think I'd been invited.
No, I don't know.
Oh, well.
It was remiss.
I'll be doing it on Skype.
It's possible. We're just not young enough anymore.
Yeah, that's very possibly the truth.
But every year they choose, I think it's 60 or 70 people they designate a young global leader. So we'll be talking to some of those people, and some of them have got some really fascinating projects. And then also, you know, we'll be looking at some of the stuff around it. So, for example, who the cooks are, who the chefs are, how the local airports deal with the sudden influx of private jets and the airspace, the security issues. There will be a little bit of fashion watching, just in terms of, you know.
Steve, I'm looking forward to this.
Oh, yeah.
This is
oh,
good.
Yeah. You know, so, for example, we're going to go down to ski shops and say, look, you know, what is it that you're selling or hiring out to the discerning CEO that doesn't really quite know what a ski boot is and is still wearing the old goggles rather than the Ray-Bans?
Oh, dear. Gosh.
Oh, dear.
There's no hope for these people. Well, Steve, we can enjoy you coming live on the briefing then on Wednesday and then stealing the show with Midori House Wednesday and Thursday live from the World Economic Forum in Davos. Steve Bloomfield, thank you as ever.
No problem.
What are we going to be doing next? We're going to be going to Oslo to talk about Picasso's endangered murals. All right, it's 1853 in London. You're tuned in to Midori House with me, Robert Bound. If you've been to Oslo and you've probably come across Picasso's monumental concrete murals in the city's government district. The murals were made by Picasso between the late 1950s and the early 70s, were created especially for Oslo's government buildings and are generally regarded as important pieces of not only art, but an important piece of Norway's architectural history. However, in July 2011, these buildings were badly damaged when Anders Breivik set off multiple explosions in and around the city's government quarter during deadly terror attacks. Breivik went on to kill 77 people. Now the government is considering the demolition of these buildings and the removal of Picasso's famed murals. The move has angered some, including the Directorate for Cultural Heritage, who says that if the buildings were demolished and the murals integrated into new ones or brought to another site, they'd no longer be the works Picasso intended. Joining me now from the Directorate for Cultural Heritage in Oslo to discuss the possible demolition of the buildings is Linda Vibe. Linda, thank you for joining us on Midori House.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. So these murals, they're very handsome works of art. One in particular sort of remains intact, which might be regarded as the most major of these Picasso murals. But why can't they just simply be patched back together and moved?
Well, the murals are integrated in the architecture, and it's basically the way both the architect and Picasso intended the work to be. So if they are moved, it will no longer be a part of the work that Picasso basically intended.
And obviously, people are very familiar with the tragedy that befell Oslo on that day. Has it taken a while for people to start thinking about things like the architecture and the murals, and be able to give them the time of day after the human tragedy?
Well, I think so. It's for the Directorate of Cultural Heritage, it's. It's important to point out the importance of this governmental quarter, both as an exclamation mark of the development of the welfare state in Norway, but also the importance it marks as a result of a breakthrough of modernism in official Norwegian architecture in the 1950s.
And what have people, has the Norwegian press, the newspapers in Oslo, been discussing this much? Do you know what the citizens of Oslo think about this? Whether they think they should stay or be let to sort of go to rack and ruin?
I think that the citizens of Oslo are divided in this question, and that is also maybe where the government is considering whether to demolish it or whether to preserve it, but the directorate has been giving a very clear advice on preserving the district.
And of course, it's the buildings themselves. I mean, as you say, these murals are integrated into the buildings. The one mural that remains, what's going to happen to that?
Well, actually, there are several murals that remains, and technical investigation of the or the governmental building, the high-rise building, shows that the building constructions are safe and that the integrated artworks are mainly intact. So they can be preserved, all of them.
And maybe you can tell us what it's like walking around this site at the moment. I mean, is it something that people can go and walk around, or is it literally a sort of halfway to becoming a demolition site?
Well, the site is still partly closed off, but you can get fairly close to the buildings and see some of the some traces of the bombing. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Linda Vibe, senior advisor for the Directorate for Cultural Heritage in Oslo. Thank you very much for joining us on the line. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer Phil Hahn, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager Chris Fitch. Up next after the news is this week's edition of Culture. That's also with me, Robert Bound. I spoke to the BBC Radio 1's Hugh Stevens about the European Music Industry Showcase event Eurosonic, which took this place in the Netherlands, and some other wonderful things like the Wapping Project on a beautiful clear day. We explored that down in East London. In 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Nancy Durham will be back for the Monocle Daily. For the time being, for me, Robert Bound, thanks for tuning in.